I'm David Malbranche, Senior Director of Global HIV Medical Affairs at Gilead Sciences. Welcome to Zero Hour, a global podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences, where we will speak with leading health and culture experts to understand the barriers that keep global populations from meaningful, transformative care. We'll shed light on inequities, we'll celebrate innovation, and together, we'll imagine a world with zero barriers, zero disparities, zero new infections, and zero people left behind. It's possible, but there's zero time to wait.
Remember that straight actor who played a queer character? Trick question. There's more than just one. If all the world is a stage, why do we often see only one kind of person in the spotlight? And why are they telling someone else's story? Across film, literature, music, and society, we're witnessing a collective shift towards valuing authentic representation and firsthand testimony. And the same is happening in conversations around HIV. I'm Christopher Chauncey Watson, and this is Zero Hour, a global podcast brought to you by Gilead Sciences.
Thanks, Chauncey. I'm really looking forward to this conversation about the power of lived experience in forging progress towards ending the HIV epidemic. As we think about the leadership of programs for people and communities affected by HIV, how important is it that we listen to people who are living with HIV? Today, we're passing the mic to two people living with HIV who are sharing not only their lived experiences, but also their efforts to have those experiences be heard and respected on their own terms. George Johnson,
yes,
is an activist, journalist, and award-winning author. Their debut memoir, All Boys Aren't Blue, came out in 2020 and is about growing up Black and queer, and about how it feels to be different, and about their journey to finding the words to express the truth of that experience.
And our second guest is Carl Schmidt. Carl is an Australian-born journalist, host, and TV correspondent known for covering Hollywood events such as the Academy Awards, the Vanity Fair Oscars party, and ABC's On the Red Carpet. George, I want to start with you, and thanks for coming today. How did you become such a strong voice on issues related to HIV?
I was diagnosed in 2010, right after my 25th birthday. And I remember what it felt like being so isolated, so alone. And I was living in Richmond, Virginia at the time. And so you only had one hospital where they sent everyone who was diagnosed. And I remember walking through the double doors of the hospital, and the first thing I saw was a sign that said infectious disease clinic. And I almost turned around and just gave up, but I didn't. And I walked through those doors and got my first set of labs done and was fortunate enough to have a Black nurse who literally made me say the Serenity Prayer over and over and over again. And from that moment, I knew that I never wanted another Black queer person to ever feel the way that I felt that day when I walked through those doors. I decided that over the next 13 years it's been since a diagnosis, that I was going to be a voice and I was going to be a person that people could look up to, that people could see being successful and thriving after diagnosis. And to be a person so that they knew that they weren't alone in that room and that I was always in that room with them. So through my work, through my advocacy, through my writing, I continue to share my story, share the stories of others in effort to empower them so that they can also walk through those double doors the same way that I had to suck it up and walk through those double doors that day.
You publish in your debut book, the memoir, and this manifesto, All Boys Aren't Blue, and you bring that voice to the table. What happened after you published?
The pandemic. the world shut down after I published, so I didn't know if we were going to sell a single book because there were no bookstores open. Mm-hmm. But what I did, I decided to open up my soul to the world, to be vulnerable and to be transparent, and simply hope that through my story, it would connect with others who felt that they've always existed, but their story had never been told. And so the beautiful thing that happened was people actually started to read the book because they had time to read books. And slowly but surely, the book started to reach communities that I didn't realize hadn't felt seen or heard in a book before. I wrote it specifically for Black queer youth. And from the messages that were coming back, it was my peers who were being freed and who were being healed. It was our elders who were reading through the text and, you know, DMing me and calling me and texting me saying, like, this is the story. Like, this is going to be the one. And I think now, seeing how banned it is across the country, we know that it is touching the nerves, touching the souls of some and touching the nerves of others. It just reminds me of how universal all of our stories truly are, even when we have multiple intersections. I'm Black, I'm non-binary, I'm queer, I'm HIV positive, and that story is still resonating in multiple languages throughout the world. And so the book has just become a testament for so many to lean into and to know that we exist.
And I actually remember being in upstate New York with my mother after my father passed and taking pictures to put on social media when the book came with me, because I'm not a big reader unless it comes to work, but I wanted to read this book and I was so proud of you. You did mention being banned.
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You could write a 320-page book, but apparently if you have four passages that talk too explicitly about sex, then the whole book should be thrown out. you know, we're just living in a time where I feel every 3 to 4 years, conservatives pick an issue. And so, you know, that's why you don't hear Antifa anymore, because it's book bans now. And so in 3 or 4 years, they won't be talking about book bans. But right now, that's the time that we're in. Realistically, there was a census that happened in 2019. It said that Gen Z was pretty much 50% white, 50% non-white, and already identifying as 20% LGBTQ. That scared people. And so now what they are trying to do, knowing that Gen Z is going to be the next population in power in terms of senators, governors, presidents, CEOs, and executives, is remove any text from them that would allow them to have empathy for the people who they actually exist with. Yep. And so in removing my work, they're removing a Black story, they're removing a queer story, but they're also removing a story that teaches about anti-racism and teaches about the history of this country. One, we know that the people who are banning the books are not reading the books. But two, this is really just a fight about what this next generation will want to do with this country. And we all know Gen Z wants to move this country in a brand new direction, and they are doing everything they can to not allow them to be educated enough to do it.
You brought in this conversation earlier about intersectionality and race and sex, and how does that begin to affect people of color, particularly queer people of color, as they access care?
What is actually Black health when I still have to deal with racism? I still have to deal with homophobia. I still have to deal with the stressors of just walking outside and my life being a threat in public. Right. And so that's really what we're talking about when we're talking about the barriers. The barriers don't just exist within the medical industry. It is about the social determinants of health, which are, did you eat today? Do you have a roof over your head? Are you educated? All of the other things that are happening outside of, oh, we were able to put this person in care. That's the term they like to use, is this person is now in care, which just means that they get their labs done 3 to 4 times a year and they take their medicine. But nobody talks about all of the other things in that person's life that prevent them from actually having health. And so that's really what we get down to when we talk about the barriers. A lot of the barriers are not just from the medical standpoint. It's like, even once we're able to break that particular barrier to get a person into care, there is so much more that still needs to be done for the totality of, we'll say, people of color who live at various intersections of poor, rich. However, many people know me because I wrote an article about my issues around U equals U, which is undetectable equals untransmittable. I love the science. I am not a big fan of the movement because the movement is a top-down approach. And that is what has always failed us when we are trying to liberate ourselves, is that we often can work with the people who are at the top, which would be, if the ultimate goal is to get everyone to be undetectable, then the movement can't start up there. It has to start with, who are the people we can't even get tested? Who are the people we, once we even get them tested and once we even get them into quote unquote care, who are the people who fall through those cracks that we can't keep in care? And so I love U equals U as a science. as something that could be a motivational tool for our communities. But I do want us to start to focus once again on who is the most vulnerable within our communities and how do we, one, prevent them from even ever being diagnosed with HIV, but two, those who are living with HIV unknowingly, how do we even get them in so that they do know about it? And how do we start to work so that people understand that you know, whether you test positive or negative, the result is always positive because you can then take action steps in your own health.
According to multiple global health organizations, including the World Health Organization and the Department of Health and Human Services, U equals U refers to the concept that taking HIV medications as prescribed and getting to and staying undetectable for at least 6 months prevents transmission of HIV to partners through sex. Undetectable means that the virus cannot be measured by a viral load test, which is a viral load less than 200 copies per milliliter.
Do we need to think differently for those seeking HIV prevention from what you're talking about and accessing?
Prevention's a toolkit. We often preach it as like, well, it's this thing, or it's do this, or it's do that. And a lot of times what we don't realize is it's hard for me as someone who is living with HIV to remember to take my pill every day. And that is the pill that keeps me alive. It is probably much harder for somebody to take a pill every day that is not necessarily working on an illness. It is working to prevent one or to prevent being diagnosed with something. That's a different mentality. And so I think we oftentimes approach it with the same model of people who are living with HIV. But I also think we need to take preventative care a step further and talk about like other ways that we do things to prevent ailments, right? Like exercise, like PrEP should be talked about with pre-exposure prophylaxis should be talked about in the same vein that we say, and you should eat this particular diet and you should exercise and you wear a seatbelt, right? Those are all things for preventative measures, but we don't talk about it like that. It's talked about in a very siloed way. And so I think we have to start to talk about like what does the totality of a person's preventative care look like in your daily life, not just in this one space of health.
Carl, I want to invite you into this conversation, and it's just so great to have you
Thank
here.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
I hope we're dressed appropriately. You know, the Academy Awards and Vanity Fair.
You look great.
But talk to us about your advocacy work.
I'm solely focused on stopping the stigma, right? And, you know, what's great is in your book, there's a line in the book where you say, you know, it's truly difficult sometimes to see yourself when you can't see others who are like you, who are thriving and successful. And so with me and the way I've sort of taken the course with my HIV, I went, okay, this is for me and some people what HIV looks like. And, you know, I'm working on television and I've created this and I've done this and I've got ambitions and I've got goals. And that's what people need to see. And I think that transcends whether you're black or white or Asian. As long as we start seeing people and start celebrating people who are getting out there, like yourself, George, and others that you have on this podcast, who are getting out there and living their best lives and doing it well, then I think you start to chip away at this mystery thing that we still think from 1984 is the Grim Reaper coming to get you. That's my advocacy. It's to normalize the conversation. We don't, you know, we used to say back in the day, oh, the C word for cancer, right? Now the C word means something completely different, but we used to call it the C word. And we never talked about divorce, right? The stigma, oh my gosh, we can't talk about the neighbors. But now we say cancer and divorce and it rolls off the tongue. We need to get to a stage where the three letters HIV and that little plus sign don't make the hairs on your arms stand up. And the only way I think we do that is to talk about it. And we don't have to agree. We can vehemently disagree on topics. That's a good thing too, right? Because maybe when you've left the room and I've left the room, you go, wow, I didn't think of it like that. So that in a nutshell is my advocacy, is to talk about it, live it, show it.
I think it speaks to the diversity of things. Like people want to say, oh, the HIV community, as if it's one monolithic community.
Yeah.
The same way they do with like, oh, the black community.
Because we don't say the cancer community, do we?
Right, we don't
say the diabetic community.
I was just about to say the diabetic
community. How about the syphilis community? Do we say that?
We don't say that.
No.
Indeed. So it speaks to that. And I think, you know, living with HIV and going public and sharing that information with other people are two very different things. So what led you to make the decision to go public about your status?
You know, I had been living with HIV up until this point at 10 years. And actually, today is the fifth anniversary of me talking publicly about it, 5 years ago today. But I'd lived 10 years, and because I work in television, and occasionally I have a platform and a voice, in the back of my head, I was always like, you know, one day I hope that I can somehow do something that is useful with this. I call it a gift, the HIV gift that I've been given. And it really is a gift, because in so many ways, my diagnosis completely saved my life. And I don't think I'm the only person who says that. A lot of people say that. So, you know, this decision, it happened very organically. I'll be honest. I'd had a couple of martinis, and someone took a photo that I thought was cute. And I went, oh, I'll put that online. And it was to the AIDS Memorial, which is a great Instagram feed. And I didn't have a story of an uncle or a friend or, you know, someone who had passed. All I had was my own story. And so I just put my own story out there and really didn't think anything of it. And within 24 hours, my life was completely changed and so much for the better.
How did it feel when you actually released that? Because you said, you know, I had a martini, like you say it very glibly, I had a martini, then I decided to just do it.
I had about three, I think.
How did it feel once you released that into the
atmosphere? You know, I really didn't think about it. I said it was after a Friday happy hour session. I did it. I shut the laptop and went to bed. But when I woke up, my social media had blown up. And then an article in Variety turned up, and then the Hollywood Reporter, and then the Daily Mail. And actually, the first thing I thought was, shit, ABC are going to think I've done this for, because, and then they started calling, and I said, they're like, what is this? And I said, I didn't know this was going to happen. I didn't think anyone would give a shit, pardon my language. But, and you know, as someone high up at ABC said to me at the time, they were like, this shouldn't be a news story. I don't understand why this is getting so much news. And she was absolutely right. But here we are in this day and age, 5 years later, it's still a news story, and it shouldn't be.
Do you think it's had impact on your professional life long term?
I had a casting friend of mine who was known for casting, hosting jobs, you know, quite famous. And he said to me over brunch last year, he goes, yeah, you know, I don't know whether I would have done that. Because, you know, I think you probably would have got a lot more work if you hadn't have. And that smacked me, because after 4.5 years, I went, wow, this is why I have to keep doing what I'm doing, because of that ridiculous comment, which he didn't mean any ill will by, but his mindset was, they think of you as the guy with AIDS on television. I mean, that's what people used to say. Don't do it, because you'll be known as the guy with AIDS on TV.
You speak about normalizing HIV. What does that mean to you?
Well, it means taking the sting out of it. You know, it's like we say, cancer and diabetes and all the other things, you know, rheumatoid arthritis. HIV still has this zing attached to it. You know, if you go up to somebody, if someone gets a cancer diagnosis, we run and we hug them and we go, my gosh. If someone says, well, I just found out I'm diabetic. Oh, God, is that, are you okay? Like now, and still you say, I'm HIV positive. They go, oh, how'd you get it? I mean, that is typically the reaction that people have. And it's just stupid. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. It's stupid. Why? Because it's the fear. Why do we have the fear? Because we're still in 1984. You know, if you want to unpack it further, especially in this country, we have a real issue about sex. We can't talk about sex. We can't say penis. We say privates. You know?
Wee-wee.
Wee-wee. Or as someone else said to me the other day, a pickle. You imagine that?
That just changes all pickles for me.
I can't.
I really like pickles.
I do too.
Yeah. But anyway, we can't talk about these things like normal people. I'm not saying we should all run around naked, but we can't talk about the thing that is as natural as breathing, right? I mean, we're all here because most of us are here because two people had sex. Everyone likes it, whether it's by ourselves, whether it's with someone, whether it's a group of people. The plants in the corner of the room have sex. We're all doing it. We can't talk about it. We've manipulated it into this disgusting, dirty, horrible thing that we all do all the time.
How does stigma overall impact HIV and sexual health. Do you see them as different, intersecting? What are your thoughts about the effect of stigma on HIV?
When we think about the overall effect of stigma, one, sex is stigmatized, and it's stigmatized from a very young age in this country. And so people don't want young adults, primarily teenagers, to even learn about sex, right? And so then when you think about HIV and how it intersects into that, gay sex is stigmatized. And HIV has now only been seen as a gay person's disease, right? You still hear people say, like, oh, that's a gay person's disease, right? You can look at the data and see Black women are affected at, you know, high rates as well. We can also see that Black men clearly are not getting tested enough because their rates are disproportionate to everyone else's, even though we know that Black men and Black women have sex. HIV automatically equals sexual shaming and sexual stigma and being demonized. People look at those who have HIV as sexually deviant. It is also why so many, you know, people who are living with HIV refuse to talk publicly about it. My sex is the same and should be the same as every other person. So that's part of the stigma too, is that it is so attached to our community that there is no way to disassociate yourself. Even just as a gay or LGBTQ person, you cannot disassociate yourself from HIV, specifically if you are Black.
And Carl, I wanna come to you, particularly coming from the Australia perspective, what is the root of that? Like when we start to think about this stigma and shame that George has shared, and what is the root of that?
Well, I think, you know, obviously I can only speak from the perspective of a white male of privilege, especially in this country and my experiences. We just pile on with all this guilt and shame associated with sex, associated with drug use. You know, I mean, I don't think a lot of people really think about drug use as an addiction and that being, you know, a health condition, not a, I just want to go and shoot up all the time. You know, once you're down that path, it's a real issue. It's a medical issue. Nobody should ever be made to feel like they've done something wrong because they got HIV. And we are still doing that. A very initial thought when they said, sorry, you've tested positive, two things happened. One, a digital red countdown clock started counting backwards over my head. And the other thing immediately I went was, how could I do this to my parents? That's the reaction when you find out you're HIV positive. I've fucked up. And it shouldn't be that way. Let's take your example and say, actually, it was the first time you ever had condomless sex. And this happens. You're a 19-year-old, maybe at college. And now you've got to jump through a million hoops to navigate how I can get to being undetectable. On top of all the other stuff that we go through personally.
At 19.
At 19 or 16 or 25 or 45 or 60, you know, that's a whole other thing. There's a lot of quote unquote straight people out there who are still having sex in their 60s and 70s who think, I'm so old now, it doesn't matter. I've done everything. It won't happen to me. And we're certainly seeing that that is just not the case. There's also a lot of men, and I think it's a cultural thing more so, and please correct me if I'm wrong. There's a lot of men who have sex with men on the down low and then go and have a lot of sex with their wives or girlfriends. And, you know, again, why is it on the DL? Because I don't want to be gay. I don't want to be called this. I don't want to be called that. I don't want to go into I don't want to walk into a clinic because the clinic says HIV or infectious disease department. What if someone sees me? Or mentally I'm going, gosh, I'm someone that potentially has an infectious disease.
Yes, and I would say we do not use the word DL.
Okay, thank you for educating me.
We have been, or what we like to say now is discreetly. You have men who are discreetly having sex with men while living their lives in the public eye as heterosexual.
It's been about 20 years since that whole down low phenomenon, because I remember starting working in Atlanta in academia, and that was part of like my research protocol that I was doing, was writing articles, publishing data to debunk that myth. Because when you look at the statistics, there was such a small percentage of Black men who were actively bisexual. You pare that down who's actively bisexual, and living with HIV and probably off their medications, so they're not undetectable.
Right.
And you start to parse down to a very small number of Black men. You mean to tell me that that small number of Black men are responsible for the entire community? It's interesting, but I think even when you bring up the phrase down low, it harkens to the importance of language.
I appreciate being educated on that. But, I want to say, there you go. That's the first time I've ever heard that. What does that tell you about the education of people getting that message?
Yeah, and it's
because I've for as much work as you do, it's the first time I've heard that. So I appreciate you educating me.
Yeah, and it's literally 20 years since we really started delving into that. And down low used to just mean secretive.
And that is in the way I was referencing it.
And then it became very much attached
to, right, Black to communities. Culture. And specifically, though, the community that it ended up harming the most, though, didn't end up being heterosexual Black men. It ended up being Black gay men and Black trans and non-binary people, because then we started to be seen as competition within our community, or like some secret thing was going on that now you had to keep an eye on your man. But it wasn't because your man couldn't have the space to exist as who they were. It was because of what y'all are doing to attract them to this side. And then HIV got caught up in that conversation. And that is how, even in certain movies, it is always portrayed, or often portrayed, when a Black woman gets HIV, it is because the man was messing with someone from queer community.
Let's dig a little bit deeper into language and how language can be stigmatizing in regards to HIV. George, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I do my best to not say infected. I do my best to say that, I was diagnosed. But I also think about how most people don't know the difference between HIV and AIDS. Mm.
You're speaking to the communication between providers and people that are entering these clinics, feeling vulnerable, feeling traumatized, needing some information and some reassurance. If that doesn't happen, they're left out there. So I wanted to bring it back to Carl. How does language, just in general, contribute to barriers in care? Like, does language contribute to, people not accessing care? How does it do that?
Of course it does. I mean, look at a real simple one, the use of the word clean. I mean, it's still being used. You'll see it if you're on any of the apps or whatever. I'm clean, UB2, DDF, which I think is drug and disease free. I think just that notion that you've got to be clean somehow goes back to that sex is dirty and what you're doing is bad. That's the simplest thing that we can just change immediately.
I used to work at a clinic in Atlanta that, in order to get into the clinic, you had to have either a T-cell count of less than 200, which meant you had the clinical syndrome of AIDS, or you manifested what we called opportunistic infections. I'm one medical provider that will explain what I think. So people would come in, since AIDS is defined as a clinical syndrome, we would sometimes see it because we realize the psychological impact it had on somebody, right? So you're not going to say somebody, if they come in with a T-cell count of less than 200, like 100, or I saw people with a T-cell count of 0, 2, 5 all the time at this clinic where I worked. Once we got them over 200, 300, 400, 500 and above, we would tell them, hey, you're just living with HIV right now. That's all you're doing. Mm. You do not have the clinical syndrome. And you could see the relief on people's faces when you told them that. And it's also something that can be empowering for some, where they say, you know what? I took my medications. I did what I needed to do. Maybe I'm eating, dieting, exercising better. But you're going to find other providers.
Yeah, but I think this is raising for me just the importance of having people like yourselves and just talk about your status, talk about why that's important, and be visible in this conversation. I'm wondering, what is the positive consequences of living your lives open and out? I'll start with you, George.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's made disclosure much more interesting. Mm. Like, no matter how many times I've publicly said this, I'm going to meet somebody who doesn't know. But because I've said it so many times publicly, I'm also comfortable within the first 5 minutes, even at a brunch full of people, I don't know, be like, yes, I'm also HIV positive. So as we talk about sex or whatever, I'm going to bring that into the conversation. So that it's one, made me more comfortable with just that. Two, I think it empowers you, right? Like, you don't have to feel like you live your life in the shadows. You don't have to whisper. It also brings out the people who are going to reject you. And I love that because I love fighting the devil I can see. So I love knowing that you're not going to date somebody who's HIV positive because I probably wouldn't date you anyway. But at least now I know that that's a barrier, right? And so I actually enjoy, like, finding out who is phobic and all of those things because I live so publicly. But I think it goes back to, like, it normalizes it. It just makes me a citizen in this country who's living with HIV. The same way you could be a citizen in this country who is living with diabetes or you're living with cancer or you're living with anything. That's what it does, I guess, for me. And I guess for others, it just removes like that veil or that weight that I think sits on you. Because a lot of times you get in that closed room, you're like, oh God, I gotta disclose.
It's coming out all over again.
You disclose it, and the other person, at least in my first couple of sexual experiences, every time I had to disclose before I was public, would be like, okay. And you're like, wait, what? And they're like, me too. Like, like, what's the big deal, right?
Exactly.
And you're just like, okay, like, what is the big deal, right? And so I think it starts to remove the veil that this is, like, such a big deal.
And it also speaks to the internalization of the external forces of stigma and how at a certain point you start manifesting that stigma within yourself. 100%. And then you come up to somebody else and you disclose or you tell the person, you share your status with them. And they're like, so? And then they keep, well, you're like, wait a minute.
Right. And I always say, like, you can't beat me with a skeleton I pulled out of my own closet.
Carl, what about you? Any positive consequences?
Yeah, I will look. I mean, the positive consequences, it made me realize, to your point, the internalized stigma that I had. For 10 years, you know, I wasn't deeply in the closet with it. I didn't talk about it professionally. But in my personal life, sure, people knew. And I had to have that painful conversation every single time. You know, I was about to get intimate with someone or it was going in that direction. Now I feel I don't have to be stressed about that. Like you said, I say it, you don't like it. Okay, see you later. We probably weren't a match. I do get frustrated that it is still incumbent on me all the time to have to tell someone that I'm living with HIV. Again, you know, we don't go for dinner and you say, by the way, I've got high blood pressure. You know, you don't, we don't, but it's perceived anyway, the way I perceive it. It is always my job and my responsibility, even if I am undetectable. And that comes, you can talk about criminalization laws in this country.
Right.
Even there's zero intent, but it's on me. And that's something that frustrates me, that if we're going to get it on, you know, we're consenting adults. If you've got questions, ask them. By all means, I'm happy to answer them. Why is it incumbent on me to have to tell you about something that, you know, is not going to infect you? That's part of the whole stigma thing too. But back to your point, the internalized stigma that I discovered I had and continue to work on it in the last 5 years, getting that out and going, wow, my God, I did a number on myself and I didn't know. Because I would go, oh yeah, you don't want to hook up with me, I'm damaged goods. And I thought it was funny. And all that shit was being stored in the back of my brain. And when it was all out there, I went, oh, wow. You know, and I was doing some stupid stuff too. Because you start to believe that if you're damaged goods and you're broken in some way, then the only place you can hang out is with other damaged goods and broken people. And you can end up in some pretty hairy, unsafe, not fun or good for your health situations.
It just reminds me, in 11th grade, I had to remember, shout out to Mrs. Blackburn, who made me remember this or memorize this poem, Paul Laurence Dunbar, "We Wear the Mask That Grins and Lies," right? And and often we find ourselves wearing those masks every day, whether one's living with HIV or not. We are living a mask of shame, but really of our own internal perspective. And I just say thank you. Before we wrap, I want to ask you both a question. Finish this sentence for me.
Okay.
The end of the epidemic looks like
this conversation. That's what it looks like. It looks like four people sitting at a table, knowing or at least working on knowing who they are and being truthful and honest. That's what the end of the epidemic looks like.
George, finish this sentence. The end of the epidemic looks like.
It looks like a world where nobody is being diagnosed, is being shamed, is being stigmatized for something that they did not create.
Thank you.
Amen.
Thank you. I think this wraps up this episode. We've got many more to go based on this conversation, but I just want to thank George and Carl for agreeing to be here and just lending your voices to this conversation. I do agree that it is conversations like this that will keep finding a solution to the end. And as you both talked about, representation matters. It matters how we're viewing the language that we're using and not using, and how do we allow the space to educate ourselves to be better practitioners, better humans, but just better individuals living in this global world. For those of us that are working in HIV or anyone that wants to see progress towards ending the epidemic, it is past time to let people who are living with HIV and those who have the lived experience take the lead in the conversation, particularly when we speak about those who need in that community and the needs of that community.
That's absolutely right, Chauncey. And for those of you listening in, if you liked what you heard today, don't forget to subscribe to Zero Hour wherever you get your podcasts and look for it on YouTube. For more information, please also visit GileadHIVTogether.com.
This presentation is protected by U.S. and international copyright laws and owned by Gilead Sciences. The podcast should not be copied, reproduced, or distributed in whole or in part without express permission from Gilead Sciences. The views expressed in this podcast are not necessarily those of Gilead Sciences.